Hello, and welcome to Deeply Disturbing Things.
I'm Macy.
And I'm Naomi, and we're two professional counselors, and this is our therapy.
Yes, and this is where we go to talk about some deeply disturbing things or some mildly disturbing things, and mostly just have fun hanging out and spending time
and
together.
Seeing each other and
connecting.
If you don't like it, then don't listen. Our listenership has been going up, and that means
more
the
trolls.
The haters are going up. So we're trying to have thick skins, but sometimes it's hard because, you know, we just do this for fun. We have jobs. Like, this isn't our job. This is like our little side thing to have fun. So it's tough. I mean, I try to, you know, be the bigger person and ignore it, but that comment over the weekend was really
So we got a comment that was rather nasty, and honestly it was just like, really, the person didn't agree with I don't know, I think I probably said something making fun of Trump about Clorox bleach, and I don't know, something along those lines with him and his statements last week. And instead of just like even saying, like, I'm totally fine when people share differing opinions, totally fine. But what this person chose to do was to post a comment that said how stupid we were, first of all, just, you know, a good foundation in the conversation. Call us, you know, stupid in the meanest words possible. And then to proceed to tell us about how we as human beings and as people are horrible and make fun of us as people, which was great. And another good way to get the point across.
Yeah, personal attacks. So luckily we have the delete power. And so we just deleted that comment and made it go away.
I block the person too. I will not tolerate it.
So love us or love to hate us, you know, we're just trying to have fun and provide some entertainment and education and basically just hang out with each other. That's why we started this whole thing in the first place.
And nobody's going to agree with everything we say, and half the stuff we say is stupid, and we get that, but we do it.
I don't even agree with what I say.
I know. Oftentimes, sometimes I listen back. I'm like, oh gosh.
Yeah, me too. I listen back. I'm like, what was I even talking about? Like, inaccurate, insensitive, incorrect. You know, why did I say that? What was I thinking?
And those comments, I would totally be like, oh, yep, they're right. But just again, you know, like, now is the time to be kind to each other. We don't need to like tear people down. You know,
and I like to be corrected. I like to, you know what I'm talking about. So
that's why I correct you all the time. And then dad corrects me.
If I don't know where Alabama is, I want somebody to tell me where it is. I thirst for knowledge.
Do you think you have that down yet? After all this?
Which thing? Where Alabama is?
Yeah.
Yes. It's on the Gulf of Mexico, just up from Florida, but only a little thin strip of Florida, because Florida stole all of Alabama's beachfront property. That's
Bam,
what I
on
figured
point.
Out.
See, this podcast teaches us things. We hope it teaches you a little, and if not, that's fine. All right. So I have a couple check-ins. One is I've found out we can track the COVID impact on people by our listenership. So we had in February and March, we were around, you know, 6,000 to 7,000 for downloads. And then April hit and we dropped down to 2,000. Like, a significant decrease. And you would think like more people are online, more people would be listening in, but like we would have like 34 people.
I think everybody was just in a panic and survival mode, just trying to figure out where to buy rice and toilet paper.
So many Amazon shopping lists that had to be completed. Yeah. So, and then it, so it went drop, huge drop. And then though now even start of May was low, with a low of 17 on Monday, but we're now up 143.9% from where we were 7 days ago.
people are getting back to life slowly but surely.
Crawling
out of the depths of darkness and despair.
Quick shout outs to our US folks, Washington, California, Arizona, Texas, and Illinois were top listeners, as well as in Canada, Ontario, Alberta, and British Columbia.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Love our neighbors to the north.
Yes, yes.
Canada, I was talking about.
The Canadians.
Maple leaf lovers.
And I just want to be the first to tell you that I got a new kitten at my mom's house, and she's adorable.
And I saw the kitten. Macy held the kitten up into the Zoom a minute ago, and super cute little tabby looking thing.
Sabrina is her name.
Sabrina. Yes. Is it after Sabrina the Teenage Witch? No. Okay.
No, just no. Okay. So I actually went up to my mom's house this weekend, though, and for Mother's Day, and we had an outdoor, like, barbecue, social distancing, just with the family, and it was really interesting. We took a family photo. We all have masks on, and we're standing, like, really far apart. Like, I can't wait to look back at this photo or have, like, my children one day look back and be like, oh, the days during COVID, just like I'm looking back at, like, the whatever, the 1918 flu or whatever, and you see everyone in the masks.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. My family just has black masks because we're just punk rock like that.
That's very cool of you. Yeah. So I think that's, let's see. Oh, I went, okay. So I had a Fred Meyer adventure where I haven't gone to many stores during all of this, and I had to go get my sister an Xbox for her birthday. And I had to go inside of the Fred Meyers, and it was kind of ghost towny. Not many people there. I wore my mask, and I'm checking out, and there were no other customers wearing masks other than the employee, or the employees, which made me just instantly anxious. And then people were walking right up next to me when they didn't have to. It was so hard not to just, like, yell at them, why? Go away.
Why? I just look over my shoulder and hiss. That seems to work.
It would have, like, in normal times, if you stood that close to me, I'd be annoyed by your presence. Like, it's just too close anyways. Ugh, okay, that's my check-in. That's all.
I don't like how when I wear a mask, it makes me conscious of if I have bad breath at that moment or not. Have you noticed that?
Of your breath?
Yeah, because you're, like, breathing and smelling your own breath at the same time, so... I found if I do a little teeth brushing before I do an outing, that makes a big difference.
I don't think I've ever been worried about my breath in an outing, but.
Well, I don't want to breathe my own bad breath is the thing.
Oh, like in the mask?
Yeah, like it recycles. It's like econ mode in the car. You know, sometimes you just need to roll down the windows and let that out.
That's fair.
Oh. I have a question for you.
Okay.
Can you pronounce Elon Musk's baby's name?
No, I started to watch the video where he was going to explain it, and then I stopped watching before he explained it.
Me too.
No, I thought you were going to tell me.
No, I didn't watch it. I saw like how it's spelled. It's like numbers and symbols and like Elven stuff.
X-A-E-something. Yeah.
Like, how do you pronounce that?
And
I'm surprised that's legal, because in a lot of states, you can't name your kid numbers or swear words or, like, Hitler, you know? So I guess in California, there's more leniency.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I'm not sure. I watched him give an interview, though, about COVID, and he feels like there was a, like, too heightened of a response, and that the government was expecting it to be worse than it was, and then it didn't end up being that, and they don't know how to backpedal from that. Not saying that it was good, but that they thought it would be much worse.
Well, I mean, we're going back out. I guess we'll see how it goes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And happy pre-birthday. Your birthday's tomorrow.
Yes, it's my birthday.
Woo woo!
I was excited.
And my birthday is the day after your birthday.
Yes, it is.
So happy pre-birthday to us, Taurus power all the way.
I took the day off tomorrow, and I thought that I was going to be 33, and then I realized I'm only going to be 32. So I'm really happy.
Wow.
My bad math. Yeah.
That's cool. I guess it's me, right? I get to go first?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sure do.
So I was doing the math, because I know when you were born, and you were like 4 when this happened. So you don't have direct memory of like experiencing it, but I'm sure you've heard of it because it's very famous. I'm going to talk about the John and Lorena Bobbitt case and domestic violence. So are you familiar with Lorena Bobbitt?
Does that have something to do with the butcher knives in the background of your photo?
It does, yes.
I know so that.
Don't peek at the chat room. No cheating, because they're probably going to say everything ahead of me, and I hate that.
So wait, look.
Don't look. Look away. Look away.
Can't force me. You're far away.
I know. On June 23rd in 1993, Lorena Bobbitt cut off her husband, John Wayne Bobbitt's penis with a 7-inch knife. So that's why my background is knives.
That wasn't much of an anticipation buildup. You basically told me what it was in the first sentence. That's horrible.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm going to dive into it.
Can you give those details again? Just one more time.
We're going to piece it up, if you will. The details of that sentence?
Yes.
Lorena Bobbitt cut off her husband's penis with a 7-inch knife.
Okay.
Okay. After police and medical responded, they learned the penis needed to be located. So they found
I thought you meant on him. That's not very flattering.
They could not find it on him. They responded, they found him bloody, like trying to, you know, apply pressure. He explained that he had no penis and that it was missing. So the call went out. This was really urgent. And this was before cell phones. So everything had to go out over the radio. And everybody was squeamish about saying the word penis back then. Like, it wasn't like now where people's like penis all day long. I guess that was a word that people really didn't say. And so they're trying to figure out a way to send this urgent message out over the radios that they needed to find his penis ASAP. So one of the calls went out and said, apparently the hospital needs it ASAP to salvage the man's dignity. So just kind of speaking in euphemisms. So the police looked all around the apartment. They looked in the dishwasher. They looked in the freezer. They looked in the garbage disposal. if it was in there, I don't know if it would be very salvageable.
Not if she did it right.
They thought that Lorena maybe had even swallowed the penis. Gross. And it was cut very clean. So in my research, I got to look at photos of both the severed penis.
The peni.
The place where the severed peni used to be and was no longer there. So it was just a total clean cut, like whoop. And I was kind of picturing in my head, like, if I was to do something like that, like, what technique would I use? And I was thinking, well, I'd probably like grab onto it, right? The top, and then like hack it, right?
Like a sea cucumber.
Keep it still and then whoop. And she had to have done it fast because he didn't wake up until it was over.
What? Was it close to the base or further down?
It was close to the base. Like, the whole thing was cut off.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it was gonzo.
Oh.
So
I just can't stop thinking about how sharp your knife would have to be. I have a hard time. Like, I tried to cut a carrot today and struggled for a little bit. Imagine.
Or if your knife's too dull and you try to cut a tomato, it just squishes. All the juice spreads out.
Yeah, and the skin just folds around it.
So I'm thinking this must have been a very sharp knife.
Yeah. I mean, whoever brand that is probably could have made some money after this.
Ooh, the special filet knife.
Yeah.
So, John said Lorena had initiated sex with him, but he was too tired. And then he woke up and realized that she had cut it off. He said he woke up and he was bleeding everywhere. He had sat there in the bed for a while or laid there in the bed for a while. And so there was this big pool of blood where he'd laid there. And when he realized his penis was gone, he applied pressure. And then he asked his friend to take him to the hospital. His friend, was spending the night with them, and they'd gone out drinking together.
So he probably got in trouble.
So he was intoxicated, so he probably didn't feel the pain right away. And so when the police came...
No, I think that's just shock. I don't think being a little buzzed would make you not feel your penis getting chopped off. I'm pretty sure it was just shock of having your penis cut off.
Interestingly, he never talked about the pain in any of the videos I saw. It was more the shock, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you've, like, broken a limb or something and that, like, or, like, when I dislocated my shoulders, like, that sheer pain, but then you just don't feel anything anymore. Until you do. Yeah.
And it's probably the psychological pain was probably worse than any physical pain it could have been experiencing. So the police found pamphlets about rape and spousal protection near the bed. So it seemed like Lorena was reading those before bed.
How do we know that it was her and not him?
Well, they learned later it was her.
I just didn't want to be sexist.
No. Oh, and thank you for reminding me. I wanted to preface this whole thing by saying this is a very, very gender binary story. So, and in a heterotypical world, this is 1993. So that's just the way the story is reported. And I just want to put out though that we're very aware that there is a lot of variation between genders and relationships, and that this is just one representation. But you have to kind of put yourself back in 1993 when phrases like the battle of the sexes was very common. So
women are from Mars and wait, no, men are from Mars. Women are from Venus, right? That book.
That's right.
Is that a thing? I don't know. I think my stepmom had that at one point.
It's a saying. In the 90s. Also, like, was it boys are more stupider? They go to Jupiter or something. Girls go to Mars, get more candy bars. I don't know. That was something from when I was little.
Why do we get candy bars?
Well, it's better than being stupider and going to Jupiter. I'll take it.
There, that'll be the next insult I give somebody.
And then there was that other one, that snips and snails and puppy dogs' tails. That's what little boys are made of.
Okay. Remember that.
Remember the girl one. Oh, sugar and spice and everything nice. That's what little girls are made of. And even as a little girl, I did not relate to that. I knew there was some issues there. I was definitely more of a snails and snips and puppies kind of youngster. So after this happened, Lorena, in a panic, drove to her work. She had the knife in her right hand and the penis in her left hand. She just ran out of the apartment, just in total shock, jumped in her car, was trying to drive. And she said she... What?
I'm sorry, I have to pause here.
Yeah.
Paul posted snips, and I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, what the heck is a snip? That you said that. You said that you're more of a something snips and... Puppies.
That's the way the saying goes. Snips and snails and puppy dog tails. That's what little boys are made of.
What is a snip?
I don't fucking know what a snip is.
I just went along with it and assumed you knew best.
I know it's a saying. I don't know what the saying means.
This is also your second topic of our podcast life that has been about penis severings. I just want to make that apparent, Paul.
It is. I think that at this point we've done enough that we can start making buckets. And so this is the penis severing bucket.
Penis bucket.
That's right. So she was said she was driving and she didn't even realize she was holding these items in her hand, the penis in the left, the knife in the right, until she tried to make a turn and it was hard and she didn't realize why. And then she looked and was like, oh God, I have a severed penis in my hand. And so she threw it out her driver's side window over the car, and it landed in the grass next to the intersection there. So,
it's gonna have like dirt chunks and stuff on it, gravel.
Oh, yeah. So, she first went to her work, nobody was there, and then she went to her friend Jana's house where Jana called the police and she told Jana, I cut his penis off. So when the police talked to her, they had to retrace her steps, and she was able to remember that it was near a 7-Eleven where she threw it out the window. And so they sent out this search crew looking for the penis, searching everywhere, high and low. And then they eventually found it. They say it may have been stepped on before they realized that it was there.
Wait, does that mean they stepped on it looking for it? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And even though they're like gloved up, these are like, you know, firefighters, first responder types, nobody like wanted to pick it up. So eventually one of them like sort of picked it up, you know, like you're carrying something that you don't want to touch. And they took it into the 7-Eleven. They placed it on ice in a hot dog bag, fitting.
What? How can you go looking for a severed penis and not have ice or a bucket or a cooler? You think you would be prepared with those items.
Right, like a transplant, organ transplant.
Yeah, situation. Like if I'm looking for a severed penis, my next thought is, what am I going to put it in?
I don't think they thought about that. I think they just rushed out with nothing. Like maybe they're just going to put it in their pocket or... I don't know.
Gloves, at least. I don't know. Nobody wants to pick that up.
Yeah, they had gloves. And even with the gloves, nobody wanted to pick it up. So they just recorded it sort of like very timid with it. So then they rushed this severed penis on ice in a hot dog bag from 7-Eleven to the OR. And the microsurgeon and urologist got to work right away, and their goal was to restore functionality, which means, you know, you can pee, you can get an erection, that stuff.
Sounds like magic.
And it was successful. John Wayne Bobbitt says after a couple weeks that he actually did get an erection. He was very happy about that. And he said it was like functioning better than ever. You know, but with some pain. So everybody's wondering what he did to make her do something like this. They did a rape kit on Lorena because she had said he had been raping her for years, both vaginally mm-hmm. and anally, and also beating her. And this case just blew up. It was a huge international thing because, you know, this is something that maybe a lot of people think about, but you don't actually do it. And it became very polarizing. Men hated her for doing this thing that, you know, they might fear the most. I mean, imagine he like went to sleep next to his wife. That's a very vulnerable thing. I'm sure men after that, you know, one guy that the interviewed said he slept on his stomach after that for quite a while. And then women were like proud of her for doing this thing that so many of them had thought of doing, but would never do. So it was very polarizing. And so at this time, like rape did not really get reported in the US. It was said in 1990 that it was estimated only 100,000 of 1 million cases were reported. Because women didn't think they would be believed or they'd be belittled or they'd be blamed. You know, this was the days where it was like, oh, what were you wearing? You know, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. Like, you did something to deserve it. It was a lot of victim blaming during these times. And there was a case that had just happened before this where the nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas, was accused of sexual harassment by his assistant, Anita Hill. And she came forward, she went on the stand, and she wasn't believed. All these men came to his defense, and he ended up getting sworn in. And she was actually blamed. So, I mean, that was 1990-ish. We're like 30 years later, and I think we're just starting to see a turnaround in this, where people mm-hmm. say, oh, you know what? We need to believe people when they come forward, you know, of any gender identity, that we need to believe them. So this case, like I said, was just huge. Like every newspaper was having some coverage. Every comedian was doing bits about it. Whoopi Goldberg, who was like really popular as a stand-up comic at that time, like did a whole set about it. You know, she's like, she told him where the dick was. I wouldn't have told him. And this was also the freeing of the word penis, which hadn't been used in the mainstream press before, which I was surprised because I think that's like the medical technical term, right?
It is, yes.
Yeah. I mean, what are they going to say? Wee-wee? Mm-hmm. Cut off his wee-wee? Yeah, so they started using penis. So this was the first time you just saw penis splashed all over the newspaper. Lorena had originally made a statement that she did it because he always had an orgasm first and not her. But English was her second language.
I was going to say, that sounds petty to me.
Yeah, English is her second language, and she was also in shock at the time the statement was made. So I don't think we can put a lot of weight on that.
What else would it mean?
Well, I think she was saying a lot of things, but the most important thing is that she was saying that he had raped her continuously. Mm-hmm. So they were both facing charges. She was facing this charge of cutting off the weenus, and he was facing charges of rape. So there was police records of the police being called on both of them over the years for domestic violence. So at this time, in order to prove spousal abuse, you had to be separate from the spouse, and you also had to be able to prove that there was bodily damage. It was a man, a wife was considered a man's property, and the woman had to have sex with the husband, even if she didn't want to. So at this time, only half the states had marital rape laws. Mm-hmm. So for the other states, if you were married, it wasn't rape. Mm-hmm. It was like your wifely duty to have sex. And this is only like less than 30 years ago.
Wifely duties.
Yeah. So Lorena said throughout their 4-year marriage, John forced her to have sex, beat her, and threatened to kill her. And John Wayne Bobbitt, bragged all the time to everybody about how strong and athletic he was. He was a Marine when the two of them met. And she was on in the U.S. on a student visa from Venezuela. So it was her dream to live in the U.S. And once they were married, she could stay here permanently. Hmm. So first, John Bobbitt went on trial for rape. He said he'd went out with friends for a few drinks. He wasn't drunk at all, he said, and then he came home to sleep. He said Lorena tried to initiate sex with him, was playing with him, but he was just too tired. And for his case, the jury was only allowed to consider the night in question and incidents within 5 days to make their decision. So they couldn't go through the whole history of all the other things that Lorena was accusing him of doing. So the laws didn't allow Lorena to speak of years and years of horrible rape and abuse that may have led up to her actions. So she described the rape in detail and in tears, but no outward signs of rape were found by the witness doctor, and a forensics expert said her panties looked cut, not torn. So like they'd been staged. Mm-hmm. And some use of force has to be shown for the court. So after 4 hours of deliberation, John was found not guilty. So I thought that was interesting that you can only focus on that night and 5 days before.
Prior.
Because I think in these cases, there's a buildup of things that lead to that. So then next, Lorena went on trial. And her charge was malicious wounding.
Yeah, that's about the bare minimum you could call that.
So John Wayne Bobbitt was hidden on a ranch in Colorado where the media wouldn't find him. his lawyers put him there. But he couldn't stay hidden because he loved attention. So, you know, he heard there was a John Wayne Bobbitt lookalike contest at a local Hooters, and he had to go out and compete in that.
Did he win?
I hope he won.
I was going to say, you would think you should have.
I mean, especially if they drop Trow, like, nobody's going to have a scar like him.
Yeah, what kind of lookalike? I mean, really?
I don't know. It's fun at Hooters, I guess.
I guess.
Hey, have you ever been to a Hooters?
No.
I haven't either. You know, we used to have one out near your house.
Yeah, it's a church now.
Oh, it's a church now. Wow.
It's a church, yeah.
How did they cleanse it of all that boob sweat?
I don't know. It looks very nice, though. They really put some money behind it.
So the whole country was making jokes about Lorena. Robin Williams was, David Letterman. There's tons of skits on SNL. Even, you know, Adam Sandler and his Opera Man character saying about it, Donde es Schlongo. And she says it did bother her because she just didn't know how to handle it. And comments were also racist. They were calling her a jealous, hot-blooded Latina.
Yeah.
So cameras were allowed into Lorena's trial. They weren't allowed into John's. So you can watch her testimony. And right before the trial, John went on Howard Stern's New Year's Eve show. And this was the start of many appearances that John made on Howard Stern's shows over the years. He appeared to not want to miss any media opportunities, radio, TV. He loved the spotlight. He loved going to clubs and concerts where he's recognized and given, you know, support. So Lorena's defense was temporary insanity, having an irresistible impulse due to years of trauma at the hands of her husband, and that night was the trigger. So she faced a 20-year sentence if she was found guilty of this malicious wounding. So the defense team needed to convince the jury that Lorena was telling the truth about the history of rape and abuse. And John was telling the court that Lorena cut off his penis because she was jealous, and he had told her he was going to leave her. So women saw it as abuse to such a degree that she was driven to strike out at what was causing her the most harm. And so many women felt empowered by Lorena's act. And men saw it as the ultimate act of horror. A lot of them took it very personally, as if their own penises were somehow in jeopardy of being sliced off.
So, well, if you start telling women, if you're mad at me, you can chop my penis off, you know.
So it caused this huge divide, you know, between the sexual majority at that time. So Lorena had to provide to a courtroom of people excruciatingly graphic details about being viciously and repeatedly raped and abused by John throughout the course of their marriage, including being raped anally. So she said he'd come in drunk late at night and she'd just know what was going to happen. And then a witness came forward and said he'd heard John telling people that he liked forced sex, that it turned him on. Significant abuse happened. So to say Lorena sliced off his penis because she just wasn't satisfied sexually or she was jealous makes the act out to be really petty, like you said.
Yeah, and then that ties onto the stereotype bit of, I mean, it's most people wouldn't do that unless they had a history of mental illness associated with a history of things like that. I mean, they have a history of fighting, which shows a pretty, you know, rocky relationship anyways, but people don't usually jump to cutting off penises.
Do you know any other cases where somebody's cut off their partner's penis?
No.
Yeah, no. I can't think of any either. So I think it's an extreme act that had to take extreme trauma to push her there.
I've heard of cases, though, where people who've been, like, sexually molested have, like, either murdered or killed the person eventually and then, like, mutilated, like, their groin area. So I've seen situations like that. Not personally. Obviously.
Yeah. So the abuse was established in court. So the next step was to determine if Lorena was so mentally ill from the abuse that she was incapable of stopping the impulse.
Hmm.
So it's very difficult.
That's hard.
Yeah, it's very difficult to prove legal insanity in the courts. So there was a forensic psychologist named Susan Feister who evaluated Lorena. And there were lots of cases that had happened that had tried to use, it was called battered women syndrome, as a defense. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times they were just unsuccessful. So the battered women syndrome type defense is saying that it's not just that single precipitating event that led to a violent act against the man. It's this accumulation of everything that had gone before. And that made me think of, you know, we work with a lot of kids that have had complex trauma. So it's not just one event. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, that shock trauma, like being in a car accident.
It's years of different kinds of trauma.
Yeah. That really just accumulates and accumulates and is very detrimental to an individual. So I kind of think it's parallel to that.
Yeah, I mean, that impacts everything from attachment styles in future relationships to behavior. And I mean, it could impact all those things. Does it take away free choice? I don't think so. Would it impact it? Absolutely. As far as the desire to do that in the moment, like impulsivity is going to be harder to resist. And I mean, I think there is a level of choice involved in that moment.
Well, that would have not got her acquitted. So,
I mean, to me, like it would have, to say that there was no choice would be like she did it as self-defense in the moment. Like he was molesting her in the moment and she did that as self-defense. Otherwise, it's the background's all there and absolutely should be considered into why she did what she did.
Yeah, the ideal is that, you know,
but he was asleep.
There's years of abuse and then you just have that thing that's just the thing that puts you over the edge.
That can be dangerous, though. I mean, just in the thought of like telling someone that, okay, there's a breaking point. And after that breaking point, anything's excused. Because that can be sketchy in my mind as well.
I think that's why it's difficult to prove this defense, the insanity defense.
Well, and going to making that plea is not a better option for, it's much harder to get out of, and say, like, I don't know, back in the day, if she would have been institutionalized, but it's much harder to get out of an institution and prove yourself sane than it would be to serve your time and get released from jail.
Well, she was looking at a 20-year sentence if she would have that mm-hmm. sentence. So the question always gets raised by ignorant individuals of why doesn't someone just leave an abusive relationship? But we know it's not that easy.
No, it's very hard. Yeah.
Individuals get trapped in that cycle of abuse. And then there can be real threats of violence. So he was mm-hmm. threatening to kill her. And when women are killed by their partners, this typically occurs within the first 6 months after they leave. So there's very real danger in leaving.
It is true. And the cycle, it's built up on this. Okay, we're going to have conflict because I'm going to start pushing things with you. And then you're going to push back or give in. And if you push back, then I'm either going to become like really appeasing. And they call it like the honeymoon phase. So like if you have a big blow up and then the person, because it could be a guy or a girl, the person then tries to be really appeasing and is really nice. And then they like crave that positive attention because of all that negative attention. And they just, it becomes a circle.
Right. The hardest time to leave is right after a big blow up, because that's when
the honeymoon phase starts.
Yeah. When the perpetrator is just like promising they're going to change and they're going to get help. Maybe they're saying they're going to go to counseling or whatever. So that's the hardest time to leave. But then things just build and it just cycles and cycles, and it usually escalates and gets worse.
And with abuse, it's not just physical. There's financial, where they like withhold money, or they can do that with kids. Verbal abuse, emotional abuse. There's a lot of different kinds that can go on. So it's not just
social abuse. Isolation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So the forensic psychologist diagnosed Lorena with PTSD, major depressive disorder, and panic disorder. And she said she concluded that she did not believe Lorena had control over her impulses at the time of the incident. Her husband had closed off all avenues of escape. He had said if she left, he would find her and continue to rape her, and that this made her crazy. She became psychotic and attacked the instrument of her torture.
Yeah, so, and that is emotionally abusive to threaten to leave if they leave, because then you feel there's no other way out.
Yep, your penis isn't going to hurt me anymore. Because I threw it out of the car into a grassy knoll. So Lorena was found not guilty by reasons of insanity. And she spent 45 days in an inpatient psychiatric hospital. So, follow-up, John ended up doing a porn movie.
Really?
Yep.
With this newly attached penis. I'm glad that's good use.
Yeah, so, I mean, if porn's your thing, maybe you want to check it out. You could see what his penis looked like after being sewed back on. But then he filmed a movie called Frankenpenis, because he wanted to have his penis enlarged. And so he did this movie to document his penis enlargement surgery, but it was totally botched and ended up disfiguring his penis. So there's that. So two movies that you could watch if you wanted to see more of John Bobbitt's penis. So then later he was charged with rape and assault by several women over the years. So he professed his innocence in his whole trial. He never ever did anything. He never showed any accountability. He said that these women later would threaten to call the cops on him if he said he was going to leave them. So he said they were false charges. But then he did eventually go to prison for 15 months because there ended up being a witness that saw him dragging one of these women through like the apartment complex. So right around this time, just after this in 1994, the body of Nicole Simpson was found, and domestic violence again was in the spotlight. So Bernie Sanders spearheaded the Violence Against Women Act, and this was signed by Clinton. But the Republicans in office did not fund it. But finally, a year later in 1995, $46 million in grants were given to fund this Violence Against Women Act. So finally, these grassroots movement had actual money behind it. So Lorena began to speak at shelters, women's shelters, about domestic violence, and found great strength there in the community of women with similar stories. And she said this is how she recovered, is in speaking with these other women. And Lorena eventually found love, and she got married and had kids, and she continues to serve women and children to this day. And she said gradually over time, her whole ordeal began to have a purpose. to tell women that they don't have to be abused, that they can escape and claim their lives again, like she did.
I've worked with several women who have in the midst of an abuse cycle and then those after, and it is such a stark comparison because those who are in the middle of it, they won't leave. Like no matter how hard you try to get them to leave or like show them the signs or here, look at this cycle of abuse that you're in.
And right. Look at this graph. Let me show you.
And it always comes down to feeling scared. Like they're terrified about what would happen and that it wouldn't just happen to them, but also maybe it would happen to other people they care about. So like it's this feeling that they couldn't. But then I've worked with people post and just, it's almost like this out of body feeling like how, I don't even know how I was able to leave and my life now feels so different. Like it's having to even like train them how to not feel crappy about themselves, how to build self-esteem again, how to feel okay about yourself, how to get in a healthy relationship. Like it messes up their life as far as how they interact with the world even after they leave the relationship.
Because they've spent the entire relationship just taking care of that person's emotions.
Yes.
And not paying attention to their own. They're so out of touch with their own emotions. So mm-hmm. It takes time to develop that self-awareness as, oh, I have my own wants and needs.
Yep. And then they just go out and they put them on the back burner. Yeah. And then trying to figure out what they do for themselves and what they do for others. And I have yet to be able to like interject and like get someone to leave in the middle of a cycle. They really have to hit that point of being ready to leave when they start to get some insight. And it takes a little while. It's strong.
It takes a while. And they may have to leave and go back several times before they get to that place.
Yeah. And they're not stupid. They know that it's bad.
Right. They may have really valid reasons for staying, like financial reasons mm-hmm. or for the kids or
fear.
Those are really valid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some people financially can't leave. And if they left, what would they do?
Exactly. It's a tough situation. And I think it's a little better now because I think there's more validation and believability. But, you know, back in the 90s, it was still quite a man's world, you know, mm-hmm. as far as men ran it, they made the rules and women were just kind of reacting and defending to everything.
So just a PSA, if you are being abused, please reach out to your local crisis hotline. If you want help, there are local community shelters that can help keep you protected and safe to be able to leave the home.
And there's been a rise in interpersonal violence, domestic violence during the shelter in place and in child abuse because everybody's just stuck together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yep. I think didn't they develop like a special code or something that you could say or punch in numbers if you're calling 911 and your abuser's right there and you don't want to like say what's happening?
I saw that too. It kind of reminds me back when I worked at the high school with the teenagers and like the kids who struggled the most, going to school was their highlight. Like, I want to go to school. I don't want to be home. Summer is when you see them go to the hospital for like suicide attempts or things like that. Mm-hmm. Because school's their connection. It's their way out of really dysfunctional homes.
Yeah.
So
I'll look up that info and post it on our socials.
Oh, man. I've got a topic. Let's see.
Your bangs look really nice today, by the way. Did you cut them again?
Do they? No, I didn't.
Oh, they look great. Mine look like shit.
I showered yesterday. That might be the difference.
Fluffed them up a little. I need a haircut so bad. Look how long my hair is.
That's really long. Like, your hair is so fast.
It's down to my nipple.
We're okay saying penis, but not nipple.
Sorry, it's down to my, what would you call it?
Nips. Nips is okay.
My titty. Is that better or worse? I don't know.
It's all uncomfortable for me. Your breasticle, you can call it that.
All right, it's down to my breasticle, and I like it above the breasticles.
So I'm going to talk today, and actually, so I got this idea because of a book that my aunt gave me a while back, and it's called My Lobotomy by Howard Dully.
Oh.
And she's actually in the room now, and she gave this to me a long time ago. And so I'm going to talk today about lobotomies, and because why not?
I think that sounds like a very interesting topic, and I can't wait to learn more.
Do you know anything about lobotomies? Is this a thing that you know? I mean, I know you know what
lobotomy is. No, just in general, I don't really know any details, so I'm super excited about this. I'm going to sit back and enjoy the show.
Cool. So I have to find my little thing here. But yes, so lobotomies are they were called a leucotomy initially, but then they later labeled a lobotomy. It's a form of psychosurgery where a neurosurgical treatment was used for mental disorders that involve severing connections in the brain's prefrontal cortex. Most of the connections to and from the prefrontal cortex, the anterior part of the frontal lobe of the brain, and they were severed. So what they would do is they would actually kind of whoosh the tool around in the brain, whoosh it to break up the neurons.
I don't know what you mean, whooshing.
By whooshing, kind of like a brushing your teeth pattern.
Oh, like an up and down, quickly.
Yes, thing. But with an ice pick in your brain.
I don't understand how that's the way you do it. Like, it seems like you'd want a smaller instrument with more delicate touch. Not just stabbing an ice pick in and out of someone's brain repeatedly to sever the brain.
Well, there was a science to it.
But I'm thinking maybe it wasn't a delicate science.
No, do you know how they, in my research, do you know how they got people to be unconscious in order to do the surgery? And not everyone was conscious, I found, or not unconscious. Some people were awake. But guess what they did?
I don't know. Punch him in the face?
They would use ECT, electroshock therapy, to make him unconscious first.
Oh, so they just shocked him out.
Yeah.
I thought that you could be conscious, though, during brain surgery because there's no pain. For the part where they, like, cut into your head, maybe you need something.
So a lobotomy went through your skull, where a lobotomy goes through your eye.
Oh.
So,
wait, which one's the ice pick one?
Lobotomy.
Okay, because I don't want... Wait, so you put ice picks through the eye?
Yes. So...
And whoosh it?
Whooshing is my preferred word for this, yes. Okay.
This is our field, Macy. I'm horrified.
I know, and it's pretty bad, like the actual...
It seems so primitive and brutal.
It is. Yes. So the transorbital lobotomy, that's where it started to go through the eye. But basically it became a mainstream procedure. Like, we laugh about it now in the sense of, like, oh, wow, horrible psychology. But it was mainstream for a while. And there was about 50,000, I think, people in the U.S. between the 1940s and 1950s that had lobotomies performed on them. So the majority of lobotomies were performed on women.
Oh.
A 1951 study of American hospitals found that nearly 60% of lobotomy patients were women. And there's limited data that showed that 74% of lobotomies in Ontario, Canada were performed on women. From the 1950s onward, lobotomy began to be abandoned in the Soviet Union and in Europe. So it took place in different countries. It comes from the word It's a Greek word meaning lobe, cut, and slice. And this is how our topics relate today.
Oh my gosh. I'm wondering if those women were acting hysterical.
Hysterical. So what was really interesting.
Which is a term that really aggravates me and vexes me to no end. It's so insulting to women's natural nature and pathologizes it. Refer back to one of our old topics.
I'm going to show you a picture
about that.
This is a picture of you can't see it.
I can see it. It's a lady with a cute little bob haircut.
Yeah. What does her face look like?
Angry.
Angry. So yes.
Vexed. Looks angry. She looks vexed like me when I hear the word hysterical.
Okay. And then how about this one? This is the same person.
Oh, she's like, oh, I'm so happy, but I have no hair because my head's been shaved weirdly.
Yes.
My cute bob is gone.
No more cute bob. So that is the person who is titled case number 121. And she was a lobotomy case. And
I'm not signing up if we're just at 121. I'll sign up at case like 50,000. It's too experimental at this stage. I'm not down with the experimental medical procedures, especially involving ice picks stabbing into my eye to sever part of my brain.
The thing is, back in the day, like, it was actually considered medical proof in journals and textbooks that facial expressions showed whether something was effective or not. So the person that did this, and I'll get to him in a minute.
Of course it's a him. I knew it was going to be a him.
The first photo you saw, he labeled her as mean, like that she had a mean face and was a mean person.
Maybe she's just thinking hard and considering something that's very serious. Asshole guy.
Well, he said, quote, that this was before operation, forever fighting the meanest woman. And then
pisses me off when I go to a yoga class and people tell me to smile. That pisses me off because sometimes you're doing something very challenging and I'm in my zone and don't fucking look at my face and tell me to smile. You don't own my face.
So this is what he said about the second photo. This is post lobotomy. And she's smiling in this photo, and the caption reads, April 4th, 1942, 11 days post-lobotomy, she giggles a lot. That's the description, is she giggles a lot.
Do they just take away her faculties and she's just, is this a Flowers for Algernon situation?
So, okay. The purpose of the operation was to reduce symptoms of mental disorder, which really, from everything I've read, it sounds like a lot of, like, schizophrenia symptoms. However, in Japan, like, most of the people who were lobotomized were young boys. So it really does speak to what they're trying. It's that, like, out of control, like, we don't know how to handle them, seems to be, like, the family's responses. So it impacted.
They're dulling their behavior so they're more manageable.
It was known that it would impact a person's personality and their intellect. So a British psychiatrist, Maurice Patridge, who conducted a follow-up study of 300 patients, said that the treatment achieved its effects by reducing the complexity of psychic life. Following the operation, spontaneity, responsiveness, self-awareness, and self-control were all reduced. The activity was replaced by inertia, and people were left emotionally blunted and restricted in their intellectual range.
That is terrible. That's so sad.
Yes.
My complexity is who I am. If I'm just reduced to, like, do I like pudding, yes or no? Like, that would fucking suck.
And people back in this era, like, they told them the possibility, and there was like a 5% risk of death just from the surgery alone. And this person said, I fully realize that this operation will have little effect on her mental condition, but I'm willing to have done it in the hope that she will be more comfortable and easier to care for. That was for a lobotomy operation on pulling.
It's for ease of caring. It's just like now they give people like you know, the Seroquel or whatever to just make people more manageable.
And that's what made this really go down was the introduction of antipsychotics, although there were a lot of other diagnoses that got kind of tied into this. So for like kids, ADHD, conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, you know, those things where the parents just didn't feel like they could manage. And a big one is trauma symptoms in children, which make children difficult to care for, would also be flagged. So really the outcomes were mixed. Some patients died. Others later committed suicide after they had the lobotomy. And several were left severely brain damaged. Others were able to leave the hospital or became manageable within a hospital. They said that some were able to return to responsible work, is what they called it. But most were severely disabled with some with impairments. And in that in-between group.
Is so, there a Moan song called Lobotomy? Or is Teenage there? Lobotomy, yeah. So just think of there a couple chords and lobotomy, lobotomy, like over and over, and that's the
song. I don't think I've heard that song. I was trying to think of it.
Oh, I'll send it to you.
Immediately post-surgeries, patients were often like confused, incontinent. Some developed an enormous appetite and gained considerable weight. Seizures were also a common complication of the surgery. Emphasis was put on training of patients in the weeks and months following surgery. So it's also been, Walter Freeman coined the term surgically induced childhood. Right.
That's so sad. I just feel like if there was better supports maybe for some of these families, they wouldn't have had to go to these extremes. Mm-hmm. Better education and support, more resources.
So the transorbital lobotomy was created by Freeman Watts, and he got it from Lima and Moniz's surgical procedure. So he adapted that, which was holes in the scalp, to being able to do it through the eye socket. So he wanted to do this because he wanted to be able to travel and like go to places to do the lobotomies and not have to have a like surgical team, where he was hoping that like outpatient psychiatrists would be able to perform this.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that in their realm? Brain surgery?
At the time. Walter Freeman believed this surgery would be unavailable to those he saw needing it most, patients in state mental hospitals. And this really was during the time when institutions were huge. And that was where people put family members. So a lot of people felt, well, I may be able to take care of my family member, or staff members may be able to take care of my family member if they are easier to manage.
I got it. It's all about easier to manage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not easy to manage. I'm difficult.
Yes, you are. So patients in state mental hospitals had no operating room, surgeons, or anesthesia, and limited money. He wanted to simplify the procedure so that it could be carried out by psychiatrists. So it's not like he just made this up out of nowhere. He really had this philosophical medical view about your brain really creating thoughts, and that you're actually separating those neurons. He was separating the obsessive thoughts that are causing the disruptions.
Get rid of those like irrational thoughts, like separate that from like maybe the actions, like the responses.
Yeah. And it did tie in the time with, his research, at least, of like where certain aspects of the brain were working. So it's not like he was just doing this on a whim. He felt very medically motivated. He was shunned by a lot in the medical community. However, there was obviously a lot of people who did it as well, who kind of picked up on that steam of doing it. And even after medications came out, he tried to show that his was better than medications. And he went around and traveled to all the people he did surgeries on to show how they've improved. And he continued to do lobotomies along the way. And he ended up stopping after one of his lobotomies ended up killing someone.
Ooh. Did anybody ever voluntarily get a lobotomy? Or was it all like
a lot of parents
voluntold?
A lot of parents having children or people who have had mental health diagnoses. So Freeman at some point conceived the idea of going through the frontal lobe through the eye socket. In 1945, he took an ice pick from his own kitchen and began testing the idea on a grapefruit and cadavers. This transorbital lobotomy involved lifting the upper eyelid and placing the point of a thin surgical instrument under the eyelid and against the top of the eye socket. A mallet was then used to drive the orbital clasp through the thin layer of bone and into the brain along the plane of the bridge of the nose, around 15 degrees towards the interhemispherical fissure. The orbital clasp was malleted 5 centimeters into the lobe and then pivoted 40 degrees. This is the whooshing I talked about. So the tip cut toward the opposite side of the head towards the nose. The instrument was returned to neutral position and set further 2 centimeters into the brain before pivoting around 28 degrees, whooshing, in a more radical variation of whooshing.
Did you come up with this term whooshing, or is this from your research?
This is my term, because everything's like sounds very surgical, but when you watch like videos or pictures of how they did it, it's just like brushing your teeth. It's just a little whooshing. That's all.
A little scrubbing.
Yeah. All the cuts were designed to separate the white fibrous matter connecting the cortical tissue of the prefrontal cortex to the thalamus in the brain.
So these thoughts would just exist on their own and not have any consequences.
Mm-hmm.
They're isolated thoughts.
So he had his first live patient in 1946. Its simplicity suggested the possibility of carrying it out in mental hospitals. And he started doing that and actually had, between 1940 and 1944, he had 684 lobotomies in the United States. He really promoted the technique as being the, like, best practice.
Well, I mean, different times, you know, maybe it was the best practice compared to options.
Yeah. Yeah.
If individuals were allowed to return home and not be institutionalized, maybe that was like a least restrictive alternative of the time.
The problem is if you're measuring progress from facial expressions, like what is the point? Is the point of it to help people get better? Because it doesn't sound like that's the point.
Well, and couldn't you just like smile at people and make them smile back and you'd be like, cured, progress, success. Cured.
Well, and it sounds like they, I mean, honestly, are just creating little house pets, like people house pets that will just smile, nod, and do what you say. So in this book, My Lobotomy by Howard Dilley, highly recommend it. It's a memoir. So he was 12 years old and had a lobotomy done, and he wasn't aware that that's what he had done until after the fact. So his parents didn't tell him about it. I was going to actually read to you a couple of things from the book that I found
Please
interesting.
Please do. I love being read to. It's my favorite.
So he said that he wasn't a stupid kid. He didn't get bad grades. He got A's and B's in history and art because they interested in him. He liked to draw. He made things up, like stories. He, on the classes he didn't like, he got C's and D's. He basically was well behaved in the things he enjoyed and got more distractible and more behavioral issues doing things that he didn't enjoy doing. He had a history of TBI. He injured his head. He ran into running down the walkway between classrooms, ran into a post, and he split his head open. He got in trouble for that.
Probably like, don't run. That's what you got. Yeah.
So
fucking his hall monitors. They're the narcs of schools.
Right. So his history was that with his dad, him and his dad got along fairly well. His dad would call him normal or wouldn't talk about any of the problems other than saying that he did have some behavioral issues. But the dad also recognized that he had aggression issues. So he would get in trouble a lot, and he would get a lot of the physical abuse that the other siblings didn't, because he acted out more behaviorally than the other kids. And his stepmom, Lou is her name, strongly did not like him as a child, had felt that his behaviors were way over the top, and she was the one that started seeking out a psychiatrist to do a lobotomy, and she was actually turned down by several who reported he was a normal kid. And until she found the creator of lobotomies, and
how did he find like a scar? And he's like, "What's a scar? Am I Harry Potter?"
They ended up telling him, and he didn't have a major like negative impact from the lobotomy, and that's kind of what his story's about. He said he recognized that like part of him felt like it was missing, and that he. It's just like this kind of like this vacancy.
And interesting.
Yeah. And especially interesting when,
unconscious brain knows what's up and has an awareness of what's going on, that it can send signals and signs to the conscious brain. I'm totally convinced of that.
So I'm going to actually read you some of Freeman's notes that he took as a psychiatrist. Of the first meeting with Miss Dully, his stepmom. So the first time Miss Dully saw the boy, she thought he was spastic because of his awkward swinging arms and peculiar gait. He seems to have poor muscular control, but he's good at many things, like athletic games at school. He dislikes to work with his hands. He doesn't build. His younger brother, Brian, likes to build houses, walls, castles out of blocks, and Howard knocks him down, throws the blocks at the wall. His name is Howard, by the way, and pounds Brian on the head with them. He objects to going to bed, then sleeps well. He watches his chance and is clever at stealing, but always leaves something behind to show what he's done. If it's a banana, he throws the peel at the window. If it's a candy bar, he leaves the wrapper around someplace and hides things in obvious places, as behind the burrow and under the bed. He doesn't play with toys. Rather, he uses them as weapons or is destructive with them. There's a dog in the home, and he teases the dog until it becomes excited, and then he punishes the dog for getting excited. He scowls and frowns if the TV is turned on to some other program. He does a good deal of daydreaming.
Oh my God, who doesn't?
And when asked about it, he says, "I don't know."
That's my response too to everything. I don't know.
So
quit asking
With this first meeting, he said that he was sufficiently impressive as a candidate, but he still wanted to have a few more meetings with the family. So the second page got a little more intense. And what's interesting, just a preface to this, this is all only from the mom. The dad wasn't aware at this point that she was meeting with him, and neither was Howard. So this is all
interesting.
And when the dad later goes in, the dad doesn't report any of this. And neither did Howard later on looking back. He's like, "I had some behavioral problems, but some of these things are just out there." All right. So when Howard and his stepbrother, who are both about the same age, were dressed for school, he didn't want to wear the new clothes, but wears jeans and shirts, often ragged, puts a sweater on the hottest days, and goes on without an undershirt on a chilly one. He turns the room lights on when there's broad sunlight out, strains his eyes to see in the dark when it comes. He hates to wash.
Oh my God. This is so normal. This is not pathological. This is me on a daily.
Well, here's where it gets a little more extended, but Miss Dully had to put him on the toilet until he was 6 years old and had to bathe him until he was 8. He used to have rather severe nosebleeds, maybe from picking, but even when blood was smeared on his face and pillow, he didn't tell about it and didn't seem to realize or acknowledge it. He still sometimes defecates in his pants or in bed or on the floor, or may wrap up a turd and hide it in the drawer.
They recently, said turd.
Says turd.
Oh my God, I hate that word.
Recently, he urinated on the wall of his room. At another time, he dribbled from his room all the way down to the bathroom and used toilet paper can be found in his closet or in his bed or in the tub.
Maybe he felt pressured to hide it because, like, everything was too strict and he felt like he couldn't just take a shit when he needed to.
Miss Dooley wanted to take Howard again to family services, but her husband objected and will probably object to coming to the office and giving his side of the picture. She thinks he is very proud and that he denies trouble rather than face it. He did have to clean up after one mess when he urinated on the floor so that it went through to the ceiling below.
Do they look into sexual abuse history?
There is no record of sexual abuse history, but there's quite a few chunks of time that he says he just doesn't remember very well.
And thanks to getting his brain cut, he never will.
But again, like, physical abuse was pretty common in the home. And teachers said that he, you know, that there were some days he was like on point and did a great job. But some days were harder, but that he was still like a good kid, but that he was the most scared kid that they had worked with.
I mean, so far I'm not hearing anything that would rise to the level of me thinking of referring someone for a lobotomy.
The only peace of mind that Miss Dooley has at the present time is when Mr. Orville Black, who is a janitor, takes Howard each Sunday for the past couple of months and is apparently able to relate to him. I asked Miss Dooley to have Mr. Black come in and tell me his experiences with the boys on Sundays. From her story, it would seem to be childhood schizophrenia, and this is rather borne out by some drawings which she found stashed away in his closet. So after reading that, he says, "Those were the notes from Lou's first visit. Could any of it be true? I'm sure I didn't wash well enough to satisfy Lou. I might have stained my underpants or dribbled on my way to the toilet. I'm sure I blew my nose and dropped the tissue on the floor, but wrapping up a turd and hiding it? Come on."
That sounds like that's way too much work for this kid.
Yeah, yeah. So he said that going there wasn't any, he wasn't included in any of the discussions. And there was a lot, he remembered a lot of arguments between his mom and his dad about it. Like, he just remembered a lot of arguing during this period. His father thought he was fine. Lou thought he was crazy. They screamed at each other, and it would make him go and hide in his room.
Remind me what year this was.
Let's see here. This would have been back in 1960.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not that old in times. Like, I feel like we're getting into, you know, close to the summer of love when maybe turds were more socially acceptable. So... Maybe it is more the environment than the kid.
Yeah, and really he continued on, and to me, like, my counselor look at this is, I would be saying the same thing you are, is, okay, have we looked at sexual trauma? Like, based on what the mom's reporting, at least.
Yeah, anything with, like, potty issues and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's a way a kid that has no control over a sexual abuse situation can gain control. And it's, of course, unconscious, but it's a red flag for sure.
So one of the teachers said, when Howard pulls some of that stuff, I almost wanted to hit him right there, right then and there. He says, every child must have some fear, but that Howard seems to be afraid of everything.
Well, maybe there's a reason, because he's getting beaten and abused and who knows what kind of horrors he's experiencing.
Miss Dooley reports that when Howard brought home one of his bad reports, his father got mad at him and his mother had to control the father so he wouldn't abuse the boy. His father being a sixth grade teacher, he might have exercised better control. Howard cries more easily than any other of these Howard cries more easily than anybody either of these ladies knows. For instance, when the boys were making a racket, Miss Dooley told them all to get out of the house. And when she looked out sometime later, Howard was way over at the other end of the lot, all alone. She went to him and tears were falling down his cheeks. She patiently explained that all the boys had been asked to leave and that he shouldn't take it too seriously. So he got scared really quickly by getting in trouble.
He's just a sensitive kid, and if he's been physically abused, then that makes a lot of sense. I mean, getting in trouble, feeling like you've done something wrong, feels like a life and death concern for kids that have you know, been physically abused.
So Lou, the mom, said, finally, she said that she's been plagued by dreams of Howard. In one of these, which keeps reoccurring, she wants to spank him, but finds that she has no right arm. That is just a weak little nub. And she interprets this as meaning that she'll never be able to spank him. Another time, a dream reoccurred that she had her teeth all set to sink into him and woke to find herself biting the pillow.
That's like, fucking weird.
Right? And
who dreams that?
So he does end up getting the lobotomy. And how
old was he when he got the lobotomy?
I believe he was 12 when he got.
God, that's so young. Like, let's see if the kid grows out of some of this shit. Like, let's not go straight to the eyeball ice pick.
So he was admitted on December 15th, 1960. To kind of a hospital-looking institute in San Jose. His dad drove him. Lou stayed home. He said he didn't remember even saying goodbye to her or to his other siblings. It was a sunny day. He just said that it was, like, pretty... He didn't really know what to expect. It just felt very medical, like a lot of medical procedures. And he said he didn't remember waking up the next morning. He didn't remember being prepared for surgery. He doesn't remember seeing Freeman. He didn't remember anything of that morning. The whole Friday disappeared. And then it was over. He said he woke up the next day, which would have been Saturday. He said he felt bad. His head hurt. He had a fever. They kept taking his blood, giving him shots. He thought something had gone wrong. And Freeman notes tell the story. Howard entered the doctor's hospital. He performed the lobotomy. The only thing that seemed to bother Howard was the needles he'd received on several occasions. So everything sounds like very unempathetic. Like the way that the doctor writes out the notes, it's very dry and procedural. Like no consideration to like what a child would be going through during that.
Yeah. Like who approves this treatment? Is it just the parents or is it like the psychiatrist?
Well, I think at that time it was the psychiatrist. So he refused to meet with them until he met with the mom, the dad, the caretaker, the janitor who saw him on Sundays, interviewed teachers, and then interviewed Howard and then agreed to it. But yeah, to me, this is on the more severe end, like trauma. This child was probably abused, well, was abused, maybe sexually abused, and not taken care of at all.
Yeah, so, no one's accountable for it, and they decide to just deal with the fallout of his behavioral and emotional issues by severing part of his brain. Neat.
Yep. Yep. So that's an example. I encourage reading the book. Again, his name is, if you just tuned in, Howard Dully. There are some other cases, though, where it did not go well. And I would, you know, caution saying that his went well, but, you know, he wasn't devastated by it. But have you heard about Rosemary Kennedy, the sister of John F. Kennedy?
No. Did she get a lobotomy?
Yes.
Really? Are these reversible? Like,
no. Okay, no, it's not reversible.
They can't wish it, reverse wish it back together.
There's no, no, no. I don't know how to opposite a wish. A shoe?
You can't shoe it and it's all better.
No. Damn it. So Rosemary returned to the United States from England in 1940. She was having a lot of mental health symptoms. She was about 22 years old. So she would get convulsions, fly into violent rages, would hit and injure other people. And she was living in like a nunnery school, that kind of setting. And she started sneaking out at night. And the nuns at the convent thought that Rosemary might be involved with men and that she could contract sexually transmitted diseases or become pregnant.
That's the first thing that'll happen.
Yep. Her occasionally erratic behavior frustrated her parents. And again, her occasionally erratic. It's not like she was constantly erratic. Again, 22 years old. Her father
22?
Was
who cares? Are they severely religious? Is that why?
Well, I mean, yeah, since she was staying in a nunnery, I'm sure.
A nunnery, yeah, okay.
Her father was especially worried that her behavior would shame and embarrass the family because they had political careers. So when she turned 23, doctors told her father that a form of psychosurgery known as a lobotomy would help calm her mood swings. Her father then decided that Rosemary should have a lobotomy. However, he did not tell his wife the decision until after the surgery was completed.
Is this real?
This is real. So because Rosemary had been diagnosed as mentally retarded, that's old diagnosis, only her father's consent was necessary. The procedure took place in November 1941. James Watts carried out the procedure at George Washington University School of Medicine.
Oh my God. I feel like Rosemary Kennedy is like we should like make her up on a pedestal for just having normal horny needs and fulfilling them. And then she was like put down and their brain cut out for like normal stuff.
Yes. I was just reading the comments. Roman Catholic, that might be right. Yeah, Catholic. So.
Well, yeah, John F. Kennedy. I know he was Roman Catholic just from my history classes that I mostly skipped. But here and there I went.
You're lucky lobotomy. If anybody would have gotten one back then with this criteria.
No, my mom tried, but I escaped. I mean, I don't know that she tried to give me a lobotomy, but she tried to have me inpatient hospitalized as a teen, but I escaped because I'm too wily. Try and catch me, motherfuckers.
So this was their description for Rosemary. They said, we went through the top of the head. I think Rosemary was awake. She had a mild tranquilizer. I made a surgical incision in the brain through the skull. It was near the front. It was on both sides. We just made a small incision, no more than an inch. The instrument Dr. Watts used looked like a butter knife. He swung it up and down to cut brain tissue, whooshing. We put an instrument inside, he said. As Dr. Watts cut, Dr. Freeman asked Rosemary some questions. For example, he asked her to recite the Lord's Prayer or sing God Bless America or count backwards. And then they made an estimate on how far to cut based on how she responded. And when she became incoherent, they stopped. How's that like for precision? Based on your responses, we'll let me know how far to cut into your brain. So
this reminds me of when we did the episode on trepanation. You just like, don't go too far. Just far enough. And like, there's really not a lot of science to how much is too far and how much is far enough.
Yeah, because everybody's goal is slightly different. Yeah. So the aftermath with Rosemary, she was immediately institutionalized because this procedure was deemed not successful. Her mental capacity diminished to that of a 2-year-old child. She could not walk or speak and was incontinent. So it really ruined her life, and she was institutionalized. She lived for several years at a place called Craig House, a private psychiatric hospital, and she lived for the rest of her life on the grounds of St. Coletta School of Exceptional Children. And she eventually, her father ended up building a private house for her about a mile outside of that campus. The nuns called the house the Kennedy Cottage.
This is fucking tragic and makes me really angry. I just pulled up some pictures of her. She's so stinking cute.
I know. Isn't she cute?
She's really cute. And like, she wasn't doing anything outside of the realm of like what we would consider absolutely normal today. Mm-hmm. I think it was just like a tragedy of her times. You know, it's just fucked up.
Yep. In response to her condition, Rosemary's parents separated her from the family. Rose Kennedy, the mom, didn't visit her for 20 years. Joseph P. Kennedy Sr. did not visit his daughter at the institution. And in Rosemary, the Hidden Kennedy Daughter, author Kate Clifford Larson stated that Rosemary's lobotomy was hidden from the family for 20 years. So while her older brother, John, was campaigning for re-election for Senate in 1958, the Kennedy family explained her absence as being she was reclusive. And they basically had used that as a excuse for her not being public in the media's eyes for that long. Eventually, they did come out and say that she was institutionalized because of a failed lobotomy, but that was only after he had been elected. John had been elected in 1961.
Ugh, that's so tragic.
Makes me sad. That is definitely the sadder, well, the saddest side. Some people did just die. There was another man, Joseph Hasid, who is a Polish violinist and composer. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia and 26 years old. They said that he would have been the best violinist that ever existed, that he was a genius. And they did the lobotomy to try to ease his mental health symptoms and ultimately ended up, he ended up dying at the age of 26 following the lobotomy.
Miss Rosemary Kennedy, I mean, she was just living her passion and being herself. And yeah, it probably didn't fit in.
Being a wild young woman.
Yeah, but I think she was just exploring her true nature, and to just reduce her to being unable to function is just criminal.
Well, and the fact that it only took the dad to sign off on it, like mom didn't even get say on the lobotomy because she had a mental retardation was her diagnosis. But again, when your parents are the only ones taking you in, and culture at the time of all of this is really important to consider, because it's the stigma of mental health at the time was still pretty, well, very high. Yeah.
I mean, when you look it up and like see her face, it like just puts a face to it, and it just makes you feel extra sad.
Yeah. And there's lots of things that science and psychology has done throughout history that is excused at the time for science, or we're making people better because the other thing is seen as worse. So it's that construct. How do you identify that a child being disruptive is worse than them being a vegetable? Well, if society's norms are your children need to be quiet and listen to you, or else you may as well not have them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know where we're going to go in culture with that. I mean, right now, a lot of things have changed in our field just in this last year, where in our state, if you're 13 years or older, you're basically in charge of your own medical decisions and family has no say. That means you can have an abortion without your family's knowing about it at age 13. But just last July, new legislation went in where families can at least put you into counseling for 3 months or like 12 visits or something like that. Like that's brand new to our state. So I don't know. I mean, it's really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And counselors, psychologists are at the front end of that, saying what is and is not okay when people come in. And
it's all based on cultural norms. The whole DSM-5 is based on cultural and political situations.
That's why it changes so frequently, and it's so unreliable as far as what will be there 3 years from now.
I threw my DSM away into the alley and let cars run over it because I just...
It's so expensive, though.
It's so expensive. I didn't actually do that, but I think about it every time. I have to like assign the diagnosis code in order to bill for services, because I just don't buy into any of it. I think it's just bullshit, and it's so tied into social political norms of the time that are constantly shifting,
and insurance companies not wanting to pay. It is so challenging to get paid by an insurance. Outpatient has gotten easier, But one thing, just having my private practice that I've noticed is, well, and noticed frequently is, say they deny a claim, and it could be something, it could be an error that they've never noticed before, and now they notice, and then they just won't pay you, and they won't give you notification, they won't tell you that they're not paying you, and then you have to like find out on your own, or you just don't get paid. Their whole shtick is to not have to pay out claims.
Right. That's their, yeah, that's their whole shtick.
Yeah, you like that?
I do. A little of the, that's the verbiage of my people.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just hard to put so much into something that means so little. And it's just, I hate it. I hate that. I hate diagnoses. I hate DSM.
It just forces you to categorize people versus like, okay, this is what's in the way. Because it, just because you are experiencing something doesn't mean it's a problem. It's only a problem if it's a problem for you. Like if it's causing disruptions in your life, yes, let's work on things to help you get better from that or feel better from that. But it's just because it is doesn't mean it's wrong.
That's right. Yeah, I agree.
Well, until next time.
Oh, fuck. What are you looking at me? I don't know. Let me think. You do yours first.
Until next time, don't live in a box.
And don't get your brain whooshed.
Or your penis chopped off. Bye, guys.
Oh, yeah. Definitely don't do that.